We'll hear arguments next in Beth Israel Hospital against the Labor Board. Chandler, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case involves the validity of a no solicitation, no distribution rule as it applies to a nonprofit hospital's cafeteria, which is used by patients, their families, and employees. The primary function of a hospital is to provide patient care, and critical to that function is providing an atmosphere as free from stress and strain as possible. The hospital's rule banning solicitation and distribution of literature, which can be disruptive to the care of patients in all patient and family access areas, including the cafeteria, is clearly in furtherance of that concern. Congress, in amending the National Labor Relations Act in 1974 to include coverage of nonprofit hospitals, explicitly stated that hospitals are unique and expressed its concern for the well-being of hospital patients and the need to avoid disruption wherever possible. This concern was recognized by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in NLRB versus Baylor, cited in the brief, and the Tenth Circuit Court in the NLRB versus St. John's Hospital, also cited, both of which denied enforcement to board orders and upheld no solicitation rules in patient access areas of those hospitals. The need and justification of Beth Israel's rule is graphically demonstrated in this case, where union literature was passed out in the cafeteria, viciously disparaging the quality of health care provided by the hospital. Let us consider the effect on an ambulatory patient visiting with his family in the cafeteria who picks up a union leaflet left on a table with statements such as the following, and I quote, "They totally ignored me while I was a patient. My experience was bewildering, painful, and ugly. I was lucky it wasn't a complicated delivery. Don't ever have a baby here unless you have a private doctor. Reports and films have become backed up. Doctors can't get their films and reports on time. Patient care is suffering."
Now, who is speaking in this material you're reading?
This is union literature distributed by employees in the cafeteria at Beth Israel Hospital, in an area where patients and their families frequent.
Mr. Chandler, the coffee shop is closed now, is it?
Yes, it is.
And why was it closed?
There was a renovation, and the space of the cafeteria was expanded to include the coffee shop area. So now there is a greater seating capacity in the cafeteria than when the case first arose.
Was the coffee shop run by the hospital per se, or by some women's organization, as many, so many do, or how?
The coffee shop was also run by the hospital, hospital personnel with employees. There were vending machines in this area and seating areas for patients and employees and visitors of patients. There were other remarks that are contained in the record appendix in union propaganda. Due to understaffing, lab specimens sit on countertops for hours. Therefore, results are misleading or altogether wrong. Much of the hospital is not maintained in a sanitary manner. Respiratory treatments ordered by doctors are not always performed. Patients who need treatments to stay alive get them, but those who need them to get better don't get them. The ratio of patients to nurses presents a hazardous environment and precludes the delivery of optimal health care. The record appendix is replete with such examples.
Mr. Chandler, I don't claim to be an expert on union organizing tactics, but this does not strike me as the ordinary union organizing literature, which would be urging claims for added benefits or criticizing the in some other way than this. Is there something in the record that suggests why this sort of criticism was resorted to?
Your Honor, the board, National Labor Relations Board, has recognized in numerous cases that union solicitation, forget about scurrilous propaganda, but the normal union solicitation as a part of an organizational campaign is potentially disruptive. And in the retail store industry, in restaurants, they find that this is enough to warrant a broad ban on such activity, union solicitation and distribution, wherever customers are present or likely to be present. What the hospital is asserting is the same interests that apply to an employer who operates a restaurant or a retail store, that patients who are sick and their families who are come into a hospital setting and understandably anxious and vulnerable, as the board itself has recognized, should be entitled to at least the same treatment as customers who come into a retail store. It's a matter of common sense.
Is one of the claims of the union, based on what you read of their literature, that the hospital is understaffed, and that's part of the union organizing, that if they get a union, they will see that it's properly staffed?
Yes, Your Honor. This is the tenor of this literature is geared towards complaints about working condition, as most union campaigns are.
And but they don't always, in their organizing stage, emphasize so much the need for more employees as this literature would appear to.
Not in other kinds of situations, but here we're dealing with a hospital, and they're raising concerns that are concerns to patients. And here, where the hospital has areas that are set aside for employees to engage in this activity, there are employee-only areas within the hospital, and they may organize, they may distribute literature in those areas without interfering with patients or their families. So the hospital feels that in order to protect patients, to insulate them from the potential disruption of this kind of literature or any kind of disruptive literature, and especially union literature, because the board itself has given its stamp of approval to banning that kind of distribution, because that in and of itself is inherently disruptive, according to the board. Controversial remarks such as this.
Does the hospital allow political candidates to come in the restaurant and to distribute?
No, they do not. As a matter of fact, the hospital's rule was promulgated initially during the Vietnam War to avoid demonstrations in the hospital throughout patient care and patient access areas. Now, the rule has been amended since then a number of times. However, the present rule involves a total ban on solicitation and distribution in patient access areas.
Mr. Chandler, does the record tell us how often this material actually fell into the hands of patients or visitors?
There is no evidence in the record, Your Honor, to indicate that it fell into patients' hands at all. However, the board, in its other case precedent, recognizes that leaflets may be left in customer access areas and may be discarded and picked up by a customer. And we feel that there's a logical inference that that could happen in this setting as well. Rather than being sensitive to the unique conditions found in a hospital and to the declared intent of Congress to recognize the special needs of patients, the board has mechanically applied rules that suit a factory environment where no patients, customers, or third parties are involved. I have already alluded to the special circumstances present in a hospital environment involving patient care considerations. Inherent in the nature of a hospital operation and the treatment of patients is the fact that patients are understandably anxious and vulnerable and likely to be upset by union solicitation and distribution in patient access areas. The board itself recognized this principle prior to the amendments, the 74 amendments, in the Guyon Valley Hospital case, which is cited in the brief.
Mr. Chandler, do you think it necessarily follows that patients would be upset by a leaflet that said, Beth Israel employees get only so much an hour, Peter Bent Brigham employees get 10% more? Do you think that would upset a patient?
I think, Your Honor, that there is a question of degrees, and if the hospital were to allow some union solicitation on a selective basis, it would create problems of deciding which to allow, which not to allow. In that particular case, I would think that there could be a problem from a patient's point of view, feeling that there is some undercurrent within the hospital that employees are dissatisfied with the hospital, and they may not be able to go about their duties properly. As I was saying earlier, the board in Guyon Valley affirmed an administrative law judge's decision, and the administrative law judge found that the hospital services ill individuals who, in their weakened condition, may readily be upset if they overhear anti-union, pro-union arguments among employees while they, the patients, are in their rooms or in the halls or elevators. And taking into consideration the nature of the institution and the necessity for protecting patients, any presumption of illegality is overcome.
Does this case involve patients' rooms?
This case does not, Your Honor.
Well, I thought you just said room.
The Guyon Valley case that I'm citing now involved patient access areas. This was a rule that was in effect prior to the amendments. The board recognized that a hospital creates a special circumstance, and they allowed, just like they did with retail stores, they allowed an exception to the normal presumptions and said that inpatient access areas, and they defined them as the gift shop, elevators, stairways, corridors, patient rooms, and so forth. This was in the administrative law judge's decision affirmed by the board. They recognized that solicitation could be prohibited. However, after the amendments were enacted in 1974, a year and a half later, despite the fact that the board conceded before the Tenth Circuit in the St. John's case that Guyon Valley represented an accurate state of the law at the time the amendments went into effect, a year and a half later in the St. John's decision, the board St. John's decision, the board, without articulating any reason for departing from the Guyon Valley analysis, without medical evidence, without any medical expertise, reversed its position. And they ruled that although special conditions exist in a hospital, that although a tranquil atmosphere is essential to a hospital's primary function of providing patient care, and that although solicitation might be unsettling to patients in strictly patient care areas, that solicitation could have no adverse effect on patients in other areas, such as cafeterias, lounges, and the like.
Did the board have jurisdiction over Guyon Valley because it was a for-profit hospital?
Yes. The Guyon Valley was a for-profit hospital and was covered by the Act. And Congress, in amending the Act to include non-profit hospitals, said that at least the same treatment should be afforded to employees and hospitals as under the prior legislation. And what has happened here is the Congress added safeguards because of the taking of jurisdiction over the non-proprietary hospitals, involving specific amendments to statutes involving getting federal mediation involved earlier, strike notices, and so forth. But they didn't give recognition to the already existing state of the law. Congress realized that the same condition should apply, and they stated as much. in the congressional record, there's ample support for the proposition that at least the same rights for proprietary hospitals should continue in effect, plus additional safeguards.
What are you suggesting that the board has the wrong standard in these kinds of cases, or are you just challenging the application of an accepted standard in this context?
I am challenging the notion of not applying at least the same standard that is applied in a customer access area of a retail store to a hospital setting where patients are involved and where Congress, in amending the act to include nonprofit hospitals, specifically stated that the board in treating these situations should give special attention to the needs of patients. So it seems to be more necessary to look at patients' needs in a hospital environment than to look at customers' needs
you're really challenging sort of the application of a rule that has evolved to the hospital.
That's correct. I'm challenging the disparate treatment of the board in the retail context and a hospital context, where in the hospital context we have specific guidance from Congress that patients should be treated specially.
Well, I suppose it depends on how high a level of abstraction you want to reach in answering my brother White's question. If you complain that the board isn't applying the same standard to hospitals as it is to retail stores, you are, in effect, complaining about the standard that the board has adopted, aren't you?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree with that.
Well, now when you say retail, do you include restaurants open to the public?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. And this is a case which involves a hospital cafeteria with a substantial number of patients and visitors that use that cafeteria.
Well,
and they are just as much customers of this cafeteria.
Is it necessary for a uniform application that there be any patients or any family in the restaurant, if it's a restaurant that just happens to be in a hospital? In other words, if they can't go into the Reeve Ghosh and distribute literature, is it your position they can't go into any other restaurant just because it happens to be in a hospital?
Yes, sir.
And it doesn't make any difference whether it...
No, it does not. And
the
as a
patients
matter of,
are nervous or the families are nervous?
That is a second position that the hospital asserts, Your Honor.
First,
we feel that the retail store precedent should be applied in this case because patients are involved. A hospital is a special circumstance in and of itself, and that interest should be protected to insulate patients from potentially disruptive influences. Secondly, this is a cafeteria. And cafeterias outside of hospital settings have been given this kind of protection against union solicitation.
But generally, in an ordinary cafeteria, the employees of the cafeteria are not sitting around at the tables, are they?
They may sit around at tables. They may intermingle with patients and visitors.
No, not a non-hospital cafeteria.
Okay.
A non-hospital cafeteria.
In a non-hospital cafeteria.
It's a usual thing to find employees sitting around at the table having lunch or dinner or breakfast.
I think we have to distinguish between employee-only cafeterias and public cafeterias.
No, I talk about a public cafeteria
open to the public.
Is it normal in such a cafeteria to find employees of the cafeteria patronizing it as customers?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, in the Goldblatt case, which is a board decision dating back to 1948, involving a department store, the board applied its retail store precedent to the department store's cafeteria, which was used by employees and customers. And there's no indication.
That was a department store rule.
That was a department store rule.
And that's your first point. Your second point is the eating place rule, right?
No, the department store has a cafeteria.
I understand.
On the premises.
I knew that.
And that's used by employees as well as customers. And the board in that case says that not only is the selling function of the department store at stake, but the rapport of customers who happen to eat in that area.
I was giving a very simple answer to my brother Stewart, that most employees that handle the food in the cafeteria know better than to eat there.
Well, I wish I had thought of that, Your Honor. In the board's McDonald's restaurant case, which is cited in the brief, the board has said, they affirmed the administrative law judge's decision.
But in this case, they were not passing out this literature to the employees of the cafeteria, were they?
There were employees working in that cafeteria.
Employees of the hotel, I mean of the hospital, but not the ones in the cafeteria. That's my brother Stewart's point.
There are employees of the hospital, however, Your Honor, that work in that cafeteria that could be distracted. This is a work area as well as a...
Well, how many employees do you have in the cafeteria?
I don't have that information. It's not on the record.
You have about 50 times that many seats, so it's obviously not for them. It's for the employees that don't work in the cafeteria.
It's for the employees that don't work in the cafeteria. It is also for the patients and visitors of the hospital.
That's right, who also don't work in the cafeteria.
That's correct.
Well, how about...
That's a little different. It's a little different, isn't it?
It's no more different than the Goldblatt case, which is also a cafeteria where there are fewer employees working, and there are off-duty employees, and there are customers that share that facility. And the board in that situation has applied the rule that we would ask them to apply in this case.
Was Goldblatt a restaurant or a department store which had a restaurant?
It was a department store that had a restaurant, Your Honor.
And I presume there would be some employees from other branches of the store than the cafeteria who ate in the cafeteria?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I suppose if it's like any other cafeteria, there are... employees circulating around constantly, taking away the trays and the plates of customers who have departed.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And that's why I indicated that this is also a work area. There are employees of the hospital that work in the cafeteria. The board in St. John's moved away from this Guyon Valley principle, and they said that only non-ambulatory patients are patients who are confined to their rooms and to immediate care areas or treatment rooms are entitled to the protection from union solicitation and distribution. That other patients who are ambulatory are better able to endure the unsettling effects which the board recognizes that might be the case in the immediate patient care areas. The board apparently has rendered its expert judgment that the unsettling effects of such solicitation and distribution for some reason are suspended while a psychiatric patient is in a cafeteria with his family awaiting psychiatric treatment, or a cancer outpatient.
Mr. Chandler, I've been trying to figure out where do you recommend the solicitation should take place?
We recommend that the solicitation be allowed in employee-only areas of the hospital.
Which are what?
There are locker rooms and adjacent restrooms in the hospital and outside of the hospital. Outside of the hospital.
Front steps. Isn't there the same danger on the front steps that maybe a leaflet will be handed to a patient not knowing he's a
patient? Yes, Your Honor. Outside the hospital on public,
why shouldn't that be
public grounds that the hospital has no control over.
It could direct its employees not to solicit out in front because it might have the same adverse effect, couldn't it?
But the hospital has no control over what may happen on public property.
But it has control over its employees, doesn't it? Why couldn't it apply the same rule? Say that you get fired because this may jeopardize the health of a psychiatric patient walking in the front door. Isn't it precisely the same risk as in the coffee shop, where 1% of the people are patients, as I understand, or 2%, something like that?
I think there's less of a risk involved because...
But there is a risk,
There is some risk, but... There is a balance, Your Honor, that has to be made.
Whereas in the coffee shop, of course, they can at least ask the person whether they're a patient or not, but I suppose it's out in front, it may be a little more difficult. People are walking along, you sort of stick a leaflet in front of them. You just figure that risk is outweighed by the need to organize in that particular context, is that right?
I believe so. In that context, yes, Your Honor. In the cafeteria, No, because there are patients who, regardless of whether they are able to walk to the cafeteria, may be quite ill and are in need of protection and insulation and in need of an environment to help them cope.
Of course, every patient, I suppose, has to walk in the front door, but everyone doesn't eat in the cafeteria. Most patients, I assume, get most of their meals in their rooms.
Most inpatients, Your Honor. There are 8 times as many outpatients as inpatients in the hospital, according to the record evidence. And there are 400 beds in the hospital, so there are substantially more outpatients who may come in off the street for
Do you mean outpatients go to the hospital cafeteria to eat?
Yes, Your Honor. They may while they're
not held there for psychiatric treatment.
The board has held that it is disruptive to organize in public areas. In other cases, non-hospital cases, they've held it in the Guyon Valley case. Our position is they should hold it in this case as well, where you have patients involved. In patient access areas, that their rule, this distinction between ambulatory and non-ambulatory, is not supported.
What if the use of the cafeteria was only minimal by patients? And I take it here that it's not a very high percentage of patients use it.
There are
not a very high percentage of the customers are patients.
There are a substantial number of customers, however. Based upon the figures that are in the evidence on an annual basis, there are over 54,000 patients and their families, visitors, who use that cafeteria just to purchase meals. And in the decision of an administrative law judge, which is appended to the brief of the petitioner in a related case, he found that patients use the cafeteria for visiting children and not necessarily to purchase meals. So there could be a substantially greater number than the 54,000.
Mr. Chandler, you keep saying that the board does not follow its own precedents. Is that your complete argument?
No, Your Honor. I think that we have here a situation where Congress has spoken. Congress has said that special attention must be given to the needs of patients. And our position is that the board has not recognized the special needs, not only because of the retail store exception, but because the hospital is a special circumstance, it's a unique environment, and should be given special attention. Thank you.
Mr. Cohn.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I think that much of my brother's argument proceeds on the assumption that when Congress enacted the health care amendments of 1974 and brought nonprofit hospitals under the National Labor Relations Act, it somehow mandated the board to restrict solicitation and distribution by employees in an organizational context. We submit that the legislative history of that statute, of those amendments, shows quite the contrary, that Congress intended to leave it to the board's discretion to continue to exercise its pre-existing responsibility to accommodate employee organizational rights and the employer's management interests, which in the case of a hospital is to maintain patient care.
Do you challenge the findings that a significant number of non-employees use that cafeteria over a period of a year?
The findings of the board, which were sustained by the Court of Appeals, and which are based upon a survey which the hospital conducted that appear at Record Appendix 124, shows that employees purchased 77% of the meals served in this cafeteria, visitors 9%, and patients only 1.56%. The remainder of the meals were purchased by students, volunteers, doctors, nurses, and others. There is no employee-only facility in this hospital. The hospital's employee's handbook states that a modern cafeteria is provided for all employees where nutritious, well-prepared meals may be purchased at reasonable prices. In short, the point that I'm making is that this hospital cafeteria is primarily a employee eating facility. The hospital held it out to its employees as such, and indeed it has used the cafeteria area to communicate with employees concerning hospital programs and has permitted employees to obtain literature there concerning a variety of commercial matters.
These controversial matters, these communications?
Well, they were not union organizational
matters. Were they controversial in any respect?
Red Cross brings us.
Well, the trial examiner at Petitioner's Appendix 33 indicates the nature of them. Posters publicizing the hospital's Buck-a-Day, a cost reduction program, travel brochure rack, carpool board, literature concerning nutritional ideas, commercial literature relating to tennis camps, film processing, magazine subscriptions, the United Fund and Combined Jewish Philanthropies drives, and things of that sort. The point is, though, that where the hospital drew the line was at solicitation and literature relating to union activity.
Mr. Combe, following up a little bit on the Chief Justice's question, the leaflets described by Mr. Chandler in his opening arguments, if this case is to depend on facts at all, and perhaps it shouldn't, seem to present the very worst possible situation for the union's position and the board's position. A good deal worse than I would think normal organizing tactics would present. Is there anything in the board's record that suggests why the union resorted to this type of statements in its organizing campaign?
I submit, Your Honor, that although some of this literature perhaps gets to the outer fringes, it still protests working conditions, and often union literature on that subject is not the exactly the language of the parlor. Now, the Court of Appeals found, I'm reading from Petitioner's Appendix 55, that Beth Israel argues that its no-distribution rule will prevent the union's scurrilous attacks, in quotes, on the hospital's health care from falling into the hands of patients. There was no evidence, however, that literature, offensive or otherwise, was distributed to patients or visitors. Employee Chunier testified that she took care to distribute only to employees.
Well, the emphasis is on distribute. Doesn't the record show that these were left on the tables and available to anybody?
I think that all that the record shows was what employee Chunier distributed and what she was disciplined for. I think that the rest of it is speculation, as the Court of Appeals so finds here. And as the Court goes on to add that if in the future In fact, scurrilous or offensive literature is distributed. The remedy is to ban that kind of literature, or to discipline employees for for distributing that kind of literature, not to ban all of it. And that is what the hospital has got here. They've got a total ban on the distribution of any union literature, even the most innocuous, or any union solicitation in any area of the hospital other than the employee-only areas. And the only employee-only areas here were the locker rooms, which on the findings of the board...
And the restrooms. You left out the restrooms.
And the restrooms.
I can conceive of you passing them out.
Yeah. The restrooms were adjoining the locker rooms, as I understand it. But on the findings of the board and affirmed by the Court of Appeals, these locker rooms were not open to all employees, and they were segregated by sex. And as a matter of fact, not even the hospital used the locker rooms or the bulletin boards in some of the locker rooms when it found it necessary to communicate with the employees. It either did so by posting bulletins in the cafeteria or by giving them flyers in conjunction with their paychecks. So that the long and short of it is that if the employee organizers, and we're not talking about outside organizers, we're talking about employees of the hospital, are not free to engaged in orderly solicitation of their fellow employees who are off duty and distribute literature to them at that time in the cafeteria, there is no other place in this hospital setting where these employees organizers can get their message across to their fellow...
What about the locker rooms you've just spoken to us about? Why isn't that a perfectly adequate place where no one has access except employees?
Well, those locker rooms are not open to all employees, so that...
any employee that's interested can carry literature in there if he wants to, can't he?
But not every employee can get access to those locker rooms.
Well, what about the entrance to the hospital?
As a matter of fact...
I mean, every employee doesn't have to go to the cafeteria, but every employee does have to come in the door.
Well, the hospital's rule, as I understand it, would also preclude distribution of literature in front of the hospital. And as a matter of fact, in the second board case involving the Beth Israel Hospital, which is still pending before the board, three employees were disciplined for handing out literature on the right in front of the entrance to the hospital.
Well, do the employees of this hospital use the same front entrance that the patients and the visitors do? If so, it's the first hospital I have ever heard of. Don't they have an employee's entrance that's special access?
So far as the record shows...
400-bed hospital?
There is no such restriction.
Well, I wouldn't believe it unless you could demonstrate it affirmatively on the record. It's just incredible to suggest that they don't have an employee's entrance.
Well, there may be an employee's entrance, but insofar as the record shows, there is no indication that they are confined to entering the hospital through that entrance.
Well, the place for distribution to employees is at the employees' entrance, is it not? That's where you're going to get the best traffic for the purposes of the union.
Well, that is certainly not the the rule with respect to other establishments. The board is entrusted with the duty of balancing the employees' organizational rights against the employer's property rights. This court has recognized that the place of work is the place that is uniquely appropriate for the employees to obtain such information. Going as far back as Republic Aviation, the court approved of the board's presumptions that working time is for work, and therefore a rule barring employee solicitation and distribution during working time is presumptively invalid, but by the same token, non-working time is the employee's own time, and therefore a rule barring solicitation and distribution during that time is presumptively invalid, absent a showing.
Even when it's only 77% of the employees and the balance is someone other than employees? That's the figure you gave us, I understood. Why should the balance of the people have to be exposed to this kind of activity? Any more than people walking into the Rive Gauche or the Mayflower Hotel restaurant?
Well, an accommodation has to be made between the organizational rights of the employees and those of the hospital.
Do you think some consideration needs to be given to the patients and the purpose of running a hospital?
Yes, Your Honor, and the board's St. John's principle, in which the board attempted to accommodate the general Republic Aviation principles to the special needs of the hospital, is an effort to make such an accommodation.
Well, are we reviewing that case or this one?
We are reviewing this case, Your Honor.
Well, where do you find any real discussion of the board's order in this case, or in the administrative law judge's decision, by the way?
Well, I think that the line that St. John's draws is between patient care areas and other areas of the hospital to which patients may have access. Now, I think that the only issue that we have in this case is the cafeteria. That is admittedly not a patient care area, but it is an area to which patients have access. And the question is whether balancing the needs of the employees for obtaining information concerning union activity in the cafeteria against the possible harm to the patient care function of the hospital, the board was reasonable in drawing the accommodation in favor of employee rights.
Where do you find any discussion by the board or the administrative law judge about such a balance as that in this case?
It is the administrative law judge's decision is replete with such discussion, Your Honor, beginning on pages...
he recites the contentions of the parties just tell me where he comes to a real finding except on page 42.
Well, I think that 42 is his ultimate conclusion. But
well, did he ever? Do you think it'd be? Do you have any? Would it be? I'll put it to you this way. Why would you treat this cafeteria different than a cafeteria in a retail store?
All right, I think we come down to that.
Well, where is
the
administrative law judge and the board certainly didn't discuss the matter.
The board discussed it in the St. John's decision, which the board referred to in a footnote in this case in affirming the administrative law judge.
So we should really look at that decision and incorporate that discussion in this case.
Insofar as the distinction between a retail cafeteria and a hospital cafeteria is concerned. And the essence of the distinction is this. I mean, the board has got to obviously, in the exercise of this discretion that it has make this accommodation in the light of the different situations that you have in different industries. This is a difficult problem that requires a lot of fine-tuning, and that's one of the reasons why Congress left it to the board, subject, of course, to judicial review. Now, the board has always had the view that an employee cafeteria in an industrial plant, for example, there was a right to solicit and distribute on non-working time. On the other hand, the board with respect to a commercial restaurant has found that that is correct, that to permit solicitation or distribution there involved too great of a likelihood of disrupting the main function of the commercial enterprise, which was to serve customers.
Even though in a department store restaurant, presumably a number of employees of the various departments would eat.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
So that all cafeterias except those in hospitals are under one roof?
Well, not cafeterias in industrial plants.
Well, cafeterias in retail establishments. All other than hospitals are covered, but hospitals are not.
Hospitals are not covered because the board believes that to permit solicitation by fellow employees and distribution in such facilities is not likely to interfere with the function of the hospital. It's not likely to interfere with patient care. That is correct.
And participating in the labor controversy helps people get well.
Well, as Judge Schweigert pointed out in the Lutheran Hospital case, which did sustain the board, in this day and age, patients are not likely to be upset by overhearing a discussion of union activity any more than they would be by overhearing doctors and nurses who talk in a cafeteria about operations or diseases or the normal things that are likely.
The same thing that was in those pamphlets.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Did Judge Swigert cite any evidence to support this conclusion, or was that just some generalization that occurred to him?
He did not cite any evidence, but there, Your Honor, I think we get back to the point that this court made in Republic Aviation, namely, that the board is entitled in drawing up these rules as to the proper balance between employee and management rights to draw reasonable inferences based upon its experience in this area, and that it is not necessary to for a board rule to be sustained to have evidence establish the results of the particular rules. I mean, they have to be reasonable.
your time has expired.
Yes,
now,
sir.
Mr. Cohn. Mr. Gold.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, continuing with the point that Mr. Cum was making, I think it is important to stress that this case brings to this Court a question concerning the validity of certain basic rules, presumptions that the Board has stated. One of those presumptions is that employee solicitation and distribution of union literature in non-working areas and non-working times and during non-working times is presumptively lawful. It's a presumption. The hospital, in any case, can seek to overcome that presumption. In this case, the hospital did not seek to overcome that presumption with any facts. What it did was say that the rules here should be presumptively lawful.
Mr. Gold, do you view this primarily as a review of a rulemaking proceeding or as an adjudication?
I would believe that it's of an adjudication. We
have substantial evidence considered on the rule.
That's right. In other words, the Board has, at least since the Republic Aviation case, followed approach of stating a presumption and then litigating the applicability of the presumption in particular cases.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock. Mr. Gold, you may continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. At the break for lunch, I was making the point that the basic board rule here is in the form of a presumption. Restrictions on union solicitation and union distribution in a cafeteria like this, says the board, is presumptively unlawful.
Well, it's like this that, in quotation marks, if I may quote you, that perhaps creates the problem. Can you have a presumption which is applied to factories and other places and have that apply with the same force to the restaurant in a hospital?
Well, what the board has done is say that in certain areas rules are presumptively lawful and others presumptively unlawful.
Well, but in a factory,
and the burden
in a factory, as you know and I know, we all know, except for a rare exception of a visiting fireman, the only people lunching are the employees and perhaps officers of the company. Here you have something that's open to 20-some percent, 23%, I think it was, of people other than employees and the considerations of the tranquility of the establishment.
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, the figures are that employees and other staff comprise 89% of the customers,
and
there
doctors,
are
doctors. Well,
I don't think they'll be the doctors would be disturbed, nor does the hospital argue it. And so the question is whether the 1.5% patients and 10% guests argue for a different presumption. And I think that the board proceeded perfectly rationally in the following sense. There are two lines of cases, as we've developed, and contrary to the impression created by the petitioner, that there's one. Line one says that where you have an employee-only cafeteria, a restriction of this type is presumptively unlawful. Presumption number two says that where the facility is primarily for the general public, such rules are presumptively lawful. And what the board did here was to say that to begin this process as a working hypothesis, we will say that this rule is presumptively unlawful and put the burden on the hospital, which after all claims to have the medical expertise, to show that that there are special circumstances which make the rule lawful. And the hospital didn't accept that invitation. Instead, they argue that what the board's presumption is arbitrary and capricious. And we think that places a very heavy burden on them under this court's general law regarding the review of administrative agency determinations, and that they haven't begun to carry it. First of all, as we have been discussing...
But it isn't a substantial evidence problem, put that way, is it? It's a statutory construction problem.
The two steps, that's right. First is, did the board proceed properly in stating this presumption?
That's a legal question.
Yes. And then, if it did, I don't think...
Well, two, isn't it? Does it proceed within its statutory authority to state any presumption? And secondly, if it may state one, it's also a second legal question, whether this was a proper one as they've created it here.
Right.
And those are legal questions, aren't they?
Yes.
So we don't get into universal camera types of inquiry or judicial review in this case.
No, I think that the problem here is exactly the same as the problem for factories and other facilities in Republic Aviation, where this court answered the first question you posed, yes, the board...
But tell me, Mr. Gould, if we agree that the presumption was proper, then we still have to determine, do we, whether the, its application on the factual record here was proper?
Yes.
On the conclusion?
Yes.
So we do have, to that extent, we have a judicial review of factual determination.
That's right. And
well, now, I know you don't have too much time, but if you do, I hope you'll be able to give a few seconds to tell me where are the factual findings here.
Okay.
Particularly with relation to this St. John's, this, what did Judge Campbell call it, puzzling footnote?
Well, on the... The footnote is, in our view, basically, the puzzling aspect of the footnote is basically out of the case because the Court of Appeals said that except as to the cafeteria, there hasn't been a sufficient articulation of the board's theory, sent all other aspects of the case back, and the board accepted the remand. So what we have here is the application of the board's presumption to this cafeteria. And the administrative
findings as to that.
The administrative law judge's findings, I apologize, I don't have the petition, I have the decision, are set forth at length at 220.
He has a long discussion, but I have a tough time with identifying any findings except that page 42.
Will you get to that summary, Mr. Gould, summarize? Is that where we find the findings based on?
No, I would say that beginning at the portion of the decision at 223 NLRB 1197, and continuing through the end of 1198, the administrative law judges. Considers each of the factors which were argued, namely the effect on patients, the discrimination point, which I would like to stress, the availability of access to people elsewhere. He reviews each aspect of the record and says that in this situation the presumption was not overcome. As to the discrimination point, which I guess will be the only thing, if I can have even 1 minute on that, we do want to make the point that the administrative law judge found, the board accepted the finding, and the Court of Appeals affirmed it as well, that the employer put a greater restraint on communications concerning union activity than on any other type of communication. And one of the best settled rules here, and we think one which is plainly derived from the Act itself, which protects discussion of union activity and other matters concerning mutual aid and protection, but doesn't protect charity drives or discussions of sporting events or public affairs, is in itself sufficient to sustain the finding here.
This is not a normal cafeteria. It is not like Reeve Gosh. I would point the court to the pictures at pages 11, 111 through 114.
But Mr. Gold, one thing worries me. If we should agree with you, how do we explain away the retail store?
Well, this was my point, Mr. Justice Marshall. In the retail store, the basic function of the cafeteria of the store is to serve the general public. Here, the basic function of this cafeteria was to serve the employees. You wouldn't walk into a general public facility and find slogans addressed to the employees. BAD means save a buck a day. You wouldn't find bulletin boards, tables set up for the employees. The employer's actions here demonstrate that this was basically a place used by employees and other staff and was the place at which employees spoke to each other. After all, union solicitation and distribution sound like archaic terms, but what they are people talking to each other or people reading literature or exchanging literature.
But they can do that in the locker rooms.
Well, as Mr. Cum endeavored to indicate, Mr. Chief Justice, only a third of the locker rooms are open to employees generally. The other locker rooms are open only to the employees who have a locker in that particular facility. And what the employer's rule does in this instance is to close off communication between somewhere around two-thirds of the employees, because what he wants to do is to say that any place you ever find a patient, it's improper for employees to be discussing unionization, whether or not they're working.
And your enlarged time has now expired.
Yes, I apologize, Mr. Chief Justice. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Chandler?
Yes, Your Honor.
We've enlarged your time to compensate for your friends.
Thank you. Briefly, there are several points in reply. The record appendix verifies that there are approximately 700 lockers in just four locker areas to which all Beth Israel employees have access. Secondly, Brother Counsel stated that the board's rule is that a rule prohibiting solicitation during work time is presumptively valid. What he neglected to say was that the board rule also says it's presumptively valid to prohibit solicitation in work areas and public or customer access areas. And here, the Beth Israel cafeteria, apart from being a place where employees are working, is a customer access area. And the customers here happen to be patients and their families. At the very least, the hospital is entitled to the same consideration. The question of numbers has been raised. The board has never raised question of how many customers are in a particular area, in an elevator of a department store or in a cafeteria in a department store. We see no reason to apply it in a cafeteria setting, especially here where there are substantial numbers. The primary function that Brother Counsel mentioned that apply in the retail store, I cite again the Goldblatt case, because in that case the primary function was selling merchandise. Cafeteria in that case was not for selling merchandise, it was for selling food, an adjunct to that operation. In the remand that Brother Counsel referred to in the related Beth Israel case, an administrative law judge made certain findings of fact. And I would read from the addendum in the brief. Solicitation
what
and distribution,
page?
This
page
is on page 49, solicitation and distribution in patient access areas can interfere with patient care functions. Such activity can be disturbing to patients and their families, persons who are particularly susceptible to being disturbed. Such disturbance can interfere with Beth Israel's primary function of curing illness. However, he goes on to say that he was bound by the board's rule in St. John's, not by the Tenth Circuit Court, which reversed the board's rule. Curiously, the board in the McDonald's hamburger case applied the restaurant rule by saying, and I quote from the decision of the board, Union solicitation can lead to heated verbal exchanges among solicitors and those solicited. Indeed, it is certainly not unknown for violent physical exchanges to occur in such circumstances. Should such there be in the presence of customers, as would not be unlikely, the employer could well foresee destruction of the rapport which this employer and any normal employer would like to have with its customers.
Well, wouldn't that be a crime?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Wouldn't it be a crime to fight?
Would it be a crime?
Yes, it would be a crime. You take care of that very simply. Calling the police and arresting the man.
You're right, Your Honor.
That solves that problem.
However, the board
has to solve that with an NLRB case.
No, we don't, Your Honor, but the board has recognized in a retail store setting, in a restaurant setting, that solicitation can be disruptive. And if they give that kind of consideration in a McDonald's hamburger place, we would expect that they'd be able to apply that same logic to a hospital setting.
Then your only complaint, I said in the original argument, you just complained about the NLRB being consistent, and there's nothing we've been able to do so far to compel them to do that. So if you expect us to do it on this case...
Well, I'd hope in this case where there is express congressional intent to give the needs of patients special attention, that this would be the case where the board has acted contrary to that congressional intent and where the court should strike them down, as did the 10th Circuit and the D.C. Circuit courts in the St. John's and Baylor cases. And I would ask that this court reverse the First Circuit's decision, as did those circuit courts, on the same reasoning.
Mr. Chandler, may I ask you one question?
Yes.
Was the rule against solicitation apply to all solicitation or just to union solicitation?
The rule was applied to controversial solicitation, Your Honor.
How was that defined?
Pardon me?
How was that defined?
As I indicated earlier, the rule originated when certain political activity was occurring in the hospital involving Vietnam, the Vietnam War, and demonstrations. That was one reason for banning that kind of activity. The hospital, talking about medical people who make a determination as to what may be detrimental to patients in a hospital setting, made a determination consistent with the board's own case law that union solicitation is potentially disruptive. They have indicated to doctors, the hospital has indicated to its staff, not to discuss concerns in patient access areas that could affect patients. And this is a consistent concern. The Baylor Court and the D.C. Circuit has recognized that this is controversial material that should be banned as opposed to innocuous things. And unless the board shows that the hospital's administration has made a bad medical judgment, then we see no basis for the board to insist upon a new rule. And as this court determined recently in the University of Missouri case against Horowitz, that involved the academic field, but there they recognized that academic people are better able to make determinations as to academic problems and subject matter than the courts or administrative agencies. Here we would suggest that the same principle applies in the medical field, especially where there was no medical evidence or medical testimony other than the board's own medical perceptions that supports its distinction for ambulatory as against non-ambulatory.
Well, did you put in any evidence about it?
Your Honor, at the time the hearing arose, the board case precedent was established, as I indicated earlier. It was the Guyon Valley precedent. We presented evidence that patients and visitors were present and that solicitation activity occurred.
With this medical judgment that you think ought to be left to doctors, we have nothing in the record about it.
I don't believe you need to pass on that, Your Honor, because of the mere presence of the customers in a patient access area, just as in the retail store. This presents a special circumstance.
Mr. Chandler.
Yes, Your Honor.
My brother Powell's question, evidently you and I didn't understand it, so let me try again. In this case, limited to this hospital, was any other solicitation other than unions barred?
in the cafeteria, there was solicitation allowed. There were pledge cards that were distributed for United
Front. I haven't said a word about what was allowed. I'm asking what else was prohibited other than union solicitation.
Doctor, I've already indicated that in the record supports it. There were numerous letters sent to staff directing them not to discuss potentially upsetting things in the presence of customers.
What, wasn't it signs up, no solicitation?
There were no signs. There was a...
Well, what did you say? No solicitation? What did you mean?
We said there are patients and
what
visitors...
What did you mean? Who did you mean should not solicit?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Your Honor.
Who was included in the phrase no solicitation? Who was no?
All employees may not solicit. Other than
anything?
Anything.
They shouldn't solicit to be repaid the money that's owed them?
That's right. In a work area, we're talking about.
Mr. Chandler.
Yes, Ron.
On the medical judgment point, can we tell from the record whether the rule was drafted by doctors and people concerned with medical problems as opposed to the possibility that it might simply have been drafted by the labor relations director?
On the face of the rule, no, Your Honor. You
or
cannot.
The record just doesn't tell us, does it?
I believe the record does indicate that Dr. Rapkin, who was the general director of the hospital, was responsible for drafting the rule.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.